This message, titled Numbering Our Days from Psalm 90, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Brothers and sisters, I remember when I was a child, and I imagine this morning that many of you would have a similar memory, but I remember as a child learning about and being fascinated with that well-known Spanish explorer, Juan Ponce de Leon. Ponce de Leon, of course, if you remember from your younger years in school, as popular legend had it, Ponce de Leon sought to discover the Fountain of Youth. Ponce de Leon had the ambition to remain young forever, to drink the waters of that fountain, to be perpetually young, to never taste, to never experience death. And I've often wondered how absolutely disappointing it must have been to this Spanish conquistador as he got involved in a skirmish. He was shot in the thigh with an arrow, as history teaches, that was dipped in poison. And this man made the final discovery of his life, that discovery being, no one can outrun death. No one can outrun death. And while the Fountain of Youth itself is something that has been passed over now as mere myth and as mere fable, brothers and sisters, that very thing that the Fountain of Youth, that Ponce de Leon thought the Fountain of Youth promised, continues to be the thing that many people in our world, many people in our society and in our culture are seeking to discover. To discover a way to evade death. When you look at the world around us, brothers and sisters, how many billions of dollars are spent every year on health products, on medication, on doctor's visits, from people seeking to avoid death? And sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes merely seeking to prolong the quantity of life, but not the quantity of life. We live in a society that is constantly seeking to redefine death. In a materialistic world, in a materialistic society. I just listened to an interview this week with a world-renowned physicist who was asked, what happens in your study of science, what happens when you die? Which is at face value a ridiculous question, because science cannot give the answer of what happens when we die. But with all the scientific authority in this physicist, him simply asserting death is nothing more, it is nothing less than the cessation of biological processes. The neurons stop firing and it is what it is. And we live in a society that wants to redefine death. We live in a culture, brothers and sisters, that often renames death in a way that takes the sharpness out, in a way that would blunt even the word death. And so we often speak and hear of people not as dying, but as having passed away, or expired, or departed. Or glibly, we try to brush away the sharp edge of death. We speak of those who are pushing up daisies, or those who have bought the barn. Brothers and sisters, we must discover, as it has been discovered again and again in human history, that no matter how we seek to avoid it, to redefine it, to rename it, there is no outrunning death. we will all meet with death. It's a sobering thought, but one we must have. Brothers and sisters, in a mere 100 years' time, it is likely that every person in this room, more than that, every single person you come into contact with every single day, it is likely that in the span of 100 years, the entire existing population today will be dead. We can't outrun death. And because of that, brothers and sisters, because of that, it is important that we think about it. It is important that we speak about it. And unwelcomed as death is, unwelcomed as that subject and that theme is, not only are we to think about it, not only are we to speak about it, but the 90th Psalm puts it into the place of our worship. Our worship of the one true and living God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Because the subject and the theme of this psalm, this sung prayer, penned by the hand of Moses, is the theme and the subject of death, of our own mortality and the waning of our own day. And with the Spirit's aid this morning, as we come to this 90th Psalm, I want to consider this theme, this subject of death, primarily in death's relationship to a number of things. Death's relationship to God, death's relationship to sin, and death's relationship to life. And so first and foremost this morning, as we come to these words, to this sung prayer of Moses, first I want you to notice this morning death's relationship to God. You'll notice, of course, that the 90th Psalm begins first and foremost. It starts immediately with a word to, a word about God. This is how it is written. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man. For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday, when it is past, or as a watch in the night. The first thing that Moses does in this prayer is he begins to define, for lack of a better expression, he begins to define death's relationship to God. And we discover in that a number of things that Moses emphasizes in this prayer. What is it that we discover about death's relationship to God? We discover here that God is untouched by death. God is untouched by death. Right? This is, in many ways, this is the emphasis, this is the focus of what we have as the second verse. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And it's one of the Bible's clearest expressions and simplest expressions of what we often call, brothers and sisters, the eternality of God. God is eternal. This is the imagery. This is the language that Moses is using. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Maybe here we can remember, even as likely Moses was dominated by a sense of this. You remember in Exodus chapter 3. As Moses was standing before the bush that was on fire but unburned, and the voice of the angel of the Lord commissions Moses to go into Egypt to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And what does Moses ask of God? He says, if I go to Pharaoh and he says to me, who sends you? What am I to say? And there in Exodus chapter 3, in that scene well known to so many of us, God discloses. He discloses by stretching the bounds of human language to give utterance to the one that sends Moses. If Pharaoh asks you who sends you, tell him, I am. Sends you. I am that I am. And this is the language that Moses is using from everlasting to everlasting. You are God. From everlasting to everlasting, you are what you are. You are never more than you are. You are never less than you are. You are God. You are all that you are from everlasting to everlasting. He is a God who inhabits eternity, and that means, by definition, brothers and sisters, God is untouched by the reality of death. What Moses is saying, to frame it this way, Moses is saying, you can look back as far as you can before the genesis of creation itself, and you can look forward as far as the imagination can comprehend, and God is unaffected by it all, because he is from everlasting to everlasting. He is God. He is untouched by death. God cannot die. Whatever Nietzsche said, God is not dead because he cannot die. Not only do we see this relationship that death has to God in that God is untouched, but Moses also brings to the forefront here that God is what? He is sovereign over death. Not only is he not untouched by it, he is sovereign over it. In verse 3, you return man to dust and say, return, O children of man. You notice who the active agent is there. The active agent is God himself. God, the one who is from everlasting to everlasting, you return man to dust. You say, return, O children of man. And again in verse 5, you sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and it withers. God is sovereign over death, brothers and sisters. He is. He is sovereign. We need to learn to understand this and to let the force of this truth invade our daily experience. God is sovereign over death. I don't know any other way to put it except to say this morning, brothers and sisters, that death is not an equal ultimate with God. We sometimes think in those dualistic terms, don't we? That there's God here who is life, and there's death here, which is not the life of God, and God and death are equal but opposed things. And nothing could be further from the truth. Death is not an equal ultimate with God. Death is subservient to. Death is the servant of the will of God. Maybe you remember the Apostle John in Revelation chapter 1 on that great and glorious Lord's Day when he was caught up in the Spirit. And what is it? Who is it that John sees there in exile on the island of Patmos? John sees the resurrected Christ. And do you remember how Christ reveals himself to John in the Apocalypse? What it is that Christ declares of himself in Revelation chapter 1 verse 18. He says, behold, I am the resurrected one. I hold the keys to death and Hades. God is sovereign over death. God is not only untouched by death, He is sovereign over death. And this, at the very start of this prayer, brothers and sisters, this then, as Moses gives to us an expression of death's relationship to God, the final thing on this point is simply to convey to us that if these things are true, then our only safety from death is God. Our only safety from death, our only safety in death, is God himself. And this Moses says in the very opening words of this prayer, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. You know, dwelling place, the word that is used there, so the word abode. You've been our place of abiding. Not only for us, but in all generations, you have been a dwelling place to your people. And when we think of that, we can think, can't we? It's not a stretch. It's easy to begin to connect the dots. When we think about what Moses means here, that God is our dwelling place, think for a moment this morning, what are our homes? What is your home to you? Your home, my home, is a place, isn't it? It's a place of safety. It's a place of protection. More than that, it is a place of comfort. It's even a place of rest. That's what our homes are. And many of us, especially here in this interesting summer of weather, have come to appreciate something of the security of our homes. Why? Because of the storms that have raged outside. Less than a month ago, on a Friday night, we had those severe storms come through. And most of us were not cowering and trembling. If you were like me and my children, you were in the comfort and the safety and the protection of your own home, staring out the window at the storm that raged, at the wind that blew and the lightning that flashed and the thunder that rumbled, with a settled sense, here I am safe, here I am protected, here is a place where I can find refuge, and all I have to do is look out, and all that will happen is I will see the storm as it passes. And how different that would be for an individual who has no dwelling, who has no house, who's cast to the outside as the violent storm comes through. There is no place of safety. There is no place of refuge. What Moses is saying, Lord, Lord, what our homes are to us, that's what you are. You are our dwelling place. You are the one who affords us safety and protection and even comfort and even rest in this life that is filled with the reality of death. God alone is our dwelling place. In God alone is there refuge and safety and security and protection. In the reality, you might say, of the storm of death. And Moses says, that's our blessing as your people, as those with faith in your promises. You yourself are our dwelling place. And so we have death's relationship to God. But secondly, as this prayer, as this sung prayer continues, not only is Moses describe here for us death's relationship to God, but we also discover, brothers and sisters, something about death's relationship to sin. Death's relationship to sin. Now you'll notice the 90th Psalm, this prayer of Moses, who's called the man of God, the 90th Psalm does not give us a specific historical reference point. When and why is it that Moses prayed this prayer? And in many ways, if you recall the life of Moses, you know that Moses' life is a life that is, can we put it this way this morning, it was a life that was often overcrowded by the reality of death. Moses, from his very birth, is confronted with the reality of death. The edict of the king goes out. All the Hebrew boys need to be drowned in the Nile. That was supposed to be the lot and the portion of Moses, to be drowned together with all the other Hebrew babies. Moses as a young man, his life is again overshadowed and overcrowded by death as he rises up and he kills the Egyptian who is threatening one of his people. Moses' life is overshadowed by the reality of death as he comes into Egypt with the announcement of God to let the people of God go. And Moses stands there, one plague after another, and Pharaoh's heart is hardened until that 10th plague, the plague of death, where the firstborn of Egypt are annihilated in an evening. Moses himself saw as he looked back on the path he had just tread by the hand of God through the Red Sea. He saw as the waters closed over Pharaoh, as the waters closed over the host of Egypt, and they were drowned. Death overcrowded, overshadowed every step of Moses' life. So there's many instances, perhaps, where he could have prayed something of this prayer. There's another instance in Moses' life, and this psalm is often connected to it. And maybe you know it well this morning. It's the experience, the tragic experience of Israel's wilderness wanderings. You remember what the inspired histories tell us? In Numbers 13, God has brought his people out of Egypt by a mighty hand to inherit the land that he promised to Abraham. The spies go into the promised land, and what do most of them do? All but two return to Moses and the people of Israel, and they say, there's no way. The men of that land, they're giants. There's no way we can go and inherit the land. And we read in Numbers 14 that the people begin to grumble and they begin to complain. And what happens? The wrath of God happens. And Moses has to intercede for the people. He has to go before the Lord with prayers and with words, pleading with God to spare the indignation of his fiery anger. And God answers that prayer, but do you remember what it is that God pronounces of that generation? In Numbers chapter 14, verses 32 and 33, this is what we read. Moses tells the people, "As for you, your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness, and your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and shall suffer for your faithlessness, until the last of your dead bodies lies in the wilderness." In an act of severe chastisement, the Lord consigns that entire generation to death. And for 40 years, every single day, every single day, people died until 600,000 men lay dead in the wilderness. In the span of 40 years, I think that amounts to about 40 men a day dying in the wilderness. And it's easy to imagine, I don't think it's vain speculation, to imagine, if not even to hear these words being prayed by Moses as he stood beside the freshly dug graves of that generation. "You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream. Like grass that is renewed in the morning it flourishes and is renewed, in the evening it fades and withers, for we are brought to an end by your anger, by your wrath we are dismayed." And why? In verse 8, "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80, but their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? For 40 years, one after another, until that entire generation lay dead in the wilderness. And every single grave that was dug, and every body that was placed in it, brothers and sisters, was a confirmation of that threat that the Lord had spoke. But as for you, your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness because of sin, because they had been faithless to a faithful God. Brothers and sisters, while this is a particular experience for Moses and the people of Israel, yet it testifies to a greater truth. That greater truth that was spoken in ancient times to our first parents, Adam and Eve. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. And they refused to take God at his word and cast themselves and all of their posterity into an estate of sin and misery. And here we have that declaration known to so many of our minds and hearts. The wages of sin is death. The relationship that death has to sin is that death is the result of sin. And brothers and sisters, this has been confirmed again and again, not merely 600,000 times, but this truth has been confirmed again and again 100 billion times in the history of humanity. The wages of sin is death. Death is the result of sin, brothers and sisters. You know, it's so interesting, isn't it? I remember as a child, In moments where I struggled for assurance, I struggled to know if God was real and if he was reliable and if he was trustworthy. And I remember as a child, in very childish ways, laying my fleece out, so to speak, asking God to prove himself. Show yourself to me, prove to me that you are who you say you are. And that's an experiment that all kinds of people seek to engage in our world while closing their eyes to the incontrovertible evidence. Death itself is evidence of the reality of God, the truthfulness of what it is that he has spoken. In the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Death, brothers and sisters, death is an infallible testimony to our sinfulness. To my sinfulness and to your sinfulness. Every time someone dies, it is witness to the verity of God's promises. Because the wages of sin is death. Every death, brothers and sisters, is the result of sin. It is the result of sin. Every time a loved one closes their eyes in this life, it is because of sin. Every casket that has its lid closed is because of sin. Every grave that has been dug, every tomb that has been erected, every cemetery that keeps the deceased is testimony to the sinfulness of the children of Adam. The wages of sin is death. And this psalm, unpleasant as it is, this psalm holds that forth for us, for our minds and our hearts, for faith to see. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins, in the light of your presence. death's relationship to sin. But then finally, brothers and sisters, Moses in this prayer, Moses in this song, teaches us to discover, you might say, death's relationship to life. Death's relationship to life. Again, I want you to notice the title of this psalm. Many of the psalms that we have in the book of Psalms bear different superscriptions. Some of the compositions that make up the 150 compositions of this book, sometimes they're called psalms. Other times they're called hymns. Other times they are songs. But here in the 90th psalm, here in the 90th, it's called a prayer. It is a prayer. And I imagine this morning that many of us have been taught, or at least you have heard of that. It's actually a very useful acronym for our prayers. ACTS, ACTS. That prayers consist of what? Prayers consist of adoration. Our prayers need to express adoration and praise, simply going to God as God. Our prayers are to have confession, the acknowledgement and the owning of sin and the pleading for pardon and the repentance that comes through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our prayers are to be filled with thankfulness and with gratitude, ACT, adoration, confession, thanksgiving. But what else are our prayers to include? Our prayers are to include supplication, asking, requesting things of God. The Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, maybe you remember what Paul says. He says, "The Lord is at hand, therefore do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, let your requests be known to God." Jesus promises that night in the upper room with his disciples in John chapter 14. Jesus promises, "Ask anything, anything in my name, and I will do it, so that the Father will be glorified in the Son." We are to request, we are to ask, we are to make our supplications known to God. And brothers and sisters, if you struggle with comprehending, as we all do on a daily basis, if you struggle with comprehending the privilege of prayer, then let me remind you of this privilege this morning. You are not only invited, we are not only compelled, you are commanded to make your requests known to God. We are commanded to ask and to request. And what is it in light of all of this, as Moses contemplates death's relationship to the eternal God, as Moses brings to the forefront death's relationship to the reality of sin, what is the request? What is the supplication of Moses in this prayer? It's verse 12. "So teach us to number our days." Teach us. Teach us to number our days. I trust this morning that all of us know, as Moses makes that request, this is not a request for an arithmetic lesson. He is not saying, "God, help me calculate. There's 365 days in every year. The years of men are 70 by reason of strength. They might be 80. So help me do this arithmetic problem and number my days to know, statistically speaking." That Moses is not here requesting an arithmetic lesson. Moses is saying, he is teaching us to say with heart and with voice, "Lord, teach me, teach us how to understand and view the days that we have been given. Help us to have a mind that understands the brevity and the frailty of life passed in this sinful and miserable world under the light of the one who is the everlasting God. Teach us, teach me how to count my days. To see these things, to see the span of my life and the waning of my years in light of these glorious and eternal truths. Teach me to understand that. And here's what we have to see and have to appreciate about this psalm is that in making that request, in teaching us that this is what we are to ask according to the will of Jesus, teach me to number my days, what we find here, brothers and sisters, can I express it this way this morning? What we find here in learning how to view our days is this: death teaches us how to live. The reality and the presence and the ever coming of the reality of death in our lives teaches us how to live. And so Moses says, doesn't he? Teach us to number our days. Why? In verse 12, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Moses understands, and what we need to discover, brothers and sisters, is that ordered by the everlasting God, living in light of the reality and the inevitability of death, teaches us how to live. It gives wisdom to us. It gives wisdom. You remember what the preacher says in Ecclesiastes. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. Because it is in the house of mourning that we discern our end. And he says, the living shall lay it to heart. But it is the fool. It is the one without sense and the one without insight and the one without knowledge who refuses to live in light of death. Teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days. That we might learn to live by mercy. Verse 13, return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. The frailty and fleetingness of our lives, brothers and sisters, evokes from the fatherly heart of God pity and mercy toward his children. So teach us to number our days that we might live by mercy. Teach us to number our days, that we might live under faithfulness. Verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast, with your faithful love. Satisfy us every morning with that. That every day, fleeting as our lives are, they are but a wisp in the mind of God. And yet every day given, brothers and sisters, every day given to you and to me is a unique day in God's creation for him to show his faithfulness to his people, to demonstrate the steadfast love. Teach us to number our days that we might live in gladness. In verse 14, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad. For as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Make us glad. That seems so contradictory, doesn't it? That living in light of numbering our days in the inevitability of death, that we should be glad. But that's what Moses, that's what God is calling us to rejoice all of our days, to be glad in what God has given, and to teach us to number our days that we might live, brothers and sisters, with purpose. With purpose. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. We might be prone to think as those destined to die, as the inevitability of death marches ever closer to each of our lives, we might be tempted to think nihilistically, well then, nothing matters, because only death is certain. But here Moses teaches us to pray, teach us to number our days, that the work of our hands would be established. To simply put it in the most practical way I can, numbering our days and living under the reality of our mortality in a very real sense gives purpose to the work we do, to the daily work we do, pleading with the Lord to establish that work, to establish the work we do with our hands. What Moses is saying here, brothers and sisters, Moses is saying this. The Lord needs to teach us to number our days. Because, brothers and sisters, in a very real sense, death teaches the children of God. Death teaches you and I how to truly live. Far, brothers and sisters, far from being something that we avoid at all costs, or redefine or rename, we are called here to mind the reality of our waning days. And it's in this way that we learn how to live. And we can do that to bring things full circle. We can learn to view death in that way, brothers and sisters, only as God is our dwelling place. Only as we find our refuge and our protection and our security in the light of His gospel. So that death is not the end, but it's the beginning of life lived in the immediate presence of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.